beginning and not enough near the end. I don't know why that happens. Monica was different, no question. At first, that crackle, that excitement, had been a draw. Later, the mood swings simply made me weary. I didn't have the patience to dig deeper. As I looked down at the pile of dirt, a painful memory jabbed at me. 2 nights before the attack, Monica had been crying when I came to the bedroom. It was not the first time. Not even close. Playing my part in the stage show that was our lives, I asked her what was wrong, but my heart was not in it. I used to ask with more concern. Monica never replied. I would try to hold her. She would go rigid. After a while, the non-responsiveness got tiresome, taking on a boy-who-cried-wolf aspect that eventually frosts the heart. Living with a depressive is like that. You can't care all the time. At some point, you have to start to resent. At least that was what I told myself. But this time there was something different. Monica did indeed reply to me. Not a long reply. One line, actually. "You don't love me," she said. That was it. There was no pity in her voice. "You don't love me." And while I managed to utter the necessary protestations, I wondered if maybe she was right. I closed my eyes and let it all wash over me. Things had been bad, but for the past 6 months anyway, there had been an escape for us. A calm and warm center in our daughter. I glanced at the sky now, blinked again, and then looked back down at the dirt that covered my volatile wife. "Monica," I said out loud. And then I made my wife one last vow. I swore on her grave that I would find Tara. A servant or butler or associate or whatever the current term was led me down the corridor and into the library. The decor was understated, though unequivocally rich. Finished dark floors with simple oriental carpets, old Americana furniture that was solid rather than ornate. Despite his wealth and large plot of land, Edgar was not one for show wealth. The term nouveau riche was to him profane, unspeakable. Dressed in a blue cashmere blazer, Edgar rose from behind his expansive oak desk. There was a feather quill pen on the top. His great-grandfather's, if I recall, and 2 bronze busts, one of Washington and one of Jefferson. I was surprised to see Uncle Carson sitting there, too. When he'd visited me in the hospital, I had been too frail to embrace. Carson made up for that now. He pulled me close. I held on to him in silence. He, too, smelled of autumn and wood smoke. There were no photographs in the room. No family vacation snapshots, no school portraits, no shot of the man and his missus decked out at a charity formal. In fact, I do not think I had ever seen a photograph anywhere in the house. Carson said, "How are you feeling, Mark?" I told him that I was as well as could be expected and turned toward my father-in-law. Edgar did not come around the desk. We did not embrace. We did not, in fact, even shake hands. He gestured toward the chair in front of the desk. I did not know Edgar very well. We had only met 3 times. I do not know how much money he has, but even out of these dwellings, even on a city street or at a bus depot, hell, even naked, You could tell that the Portmans were from money. Monica had the bearing, too. The one ingrained over generations. The one that cannot be taught. The one that may literally be genetic. Monica's choice to live in our relatively modest dwelling was probably a form of rebellion. She had hated her father. I was not a big fan of his either, probably because I had met his type before. Edgar thinks himself a pull-up-by-the-bootstrap sort, but he himself earned his money the old-fashioned way. He inherited it. I don't know many super wealthy people, but I noticed that the more things were handed to you on a silver platter, the more you complain about welfare mothers and government handouts. It is bizarre. Edgar belongs to that unique class of the entitled who have deluded themselves into believing that they somehow earned their status through hard work. We all live with self-justification, of course, and if you have never fended for yourself, if you live in luxury and have done nothing to deserve it, well, that is going to compound your insecurities, I guess. But it shouldn't make you such a prig to boot. I sat. Edgar followed suit. Carson remained standing. I stared at Edgar. He had the plump of the well-fed. His face was all soft edges. The normal ruddy on his cheeks, so far from anything raw bone, was gone now. He laced his fingers and rested them on his paunch. He looked, I was somewhat surprised to see, devastated, drawn, and sapless. I say surprised because Edgar always struck me as pure id, a person whose own pain and pleasure trumped all others, who believed those who inhabited the space around him were little more than window dressing for his own bemusement. Edgar had now lost two children. His son, Eddie IV, had died while speeding under the influence 10 years ago. According to Monica, Eddie veered across the double yellow line and plowed into the semi on purpose. For some reason, she blamed her father. She blamed him for a lot of things. There is also Monica's mother. I have met her only twice. She rests a lot. She takes extended vacations. In short, she is in and out of institutions. Both times we met, my mother-in-law was propped up for some social affair, well-dressed and powdered, lovely and too pale. A vacancy in her eyes, a slur in her speech, a sway in her stance. Except for Uncle Carson, Monica was estranged from her family. As you might imagine, I hardly minded. "You wanted to see me?" I said. "Yes, Mark." "Yes, I did." I waited. Edgar put his hands on his desk. "Did you love my daughter?" I was caught off guard, but I still said, "Very much." With no hesitation. He seemed to see the lie. I worked hard to keep my gaze steady. "She still wasn't happy, you know." "I'm not sure you can blame me for that," I said. He nodded slowly.
"Fair point.
But my own pass-the-buck defense didn't really work on me." Edgar's words were a fresh body blow. The guilt came roaring back. "Did you know that she was seeing a psychiatrist?" Edgar asked. I turned toward Carson first, then back to Edgar. "No."
"She didn't want anyone to know."
"How did you find out?"
Edgar did not reply.
He stared down at his hands.
Then he said, "I want to show you something."
I sneaked another look at Uncle Carson.
His jaw was set. I thought I saw it tremble. I turned back to Edgar. Okay. Edgar opened his desk drawer, reached in, and pulled out a plastic bag. He raised it into view, gripping the bag at the corner between his forefinger and thumb. It took a moment, but when I realized what I was looking at, my eyes went wide. Edgar saw my reaction. You recognize it, then? I couldn't speak at first. I glanced over at Carson. His eyes were red. I looked back at Edgar and nodded, numbly. Inside the plastic bag was a small swatch of clothing, maybe 3 inches by 3 inches. The pattern was one I had seen 2 weeks ago, moments before being shot. Pink, with black penguins. My voice was barely a hush. Where did you get this? Edgar handed me a large brown envelope, the kind with bubble wrap on the inside. This, too, was protected in plastic. I turned it around. Edgar's name and address had been printed on a white label. There was no return address. The postmark read New York City. It came in today's mail, Edgar said. He gestured to the swatch. Is it Tara's? I think I said yes. There's more, Edgar said. He reached into the drawer again. I took the liberty of putting everything in plastic bags, in case the authorities need to test it. Again, he handed me what looked like a Ziploc bag. Smaller this time. There were hairs inside. Little wisps of hair. With mounting dread, I realized what I was looking at. My breath stopped. Baby hair. From far away, I heard Edgar ask, "Are they hers?" I closed my eyes and tried to picture Tara in the crib. The image of my daughter, I was horrified to realize, was already fading in the mind's eyes. How could that be? I could no longer tell if I was seeing memory or something I conjured up to replace what I was already forgetting. Damn it. Tears pressed against my eyelids. I tried to bring back the feel of my daughter's soft scalp, the way my finger would trace the top. Mark. It could be, I said, opening my eyes. There's no way for me to know for sure. Something else, Edgar said. He handed me another plastic bag. Gingerly, I put down the bag with her hair on the desk. I took the new bag. There was a sheet of white paper in it. A note from some kind of laser printer. If you contact the authorities, we disappear. You will never know what happened to her. We will be watching. We will know. We have a man on the inside. Your calls are being monitored. Do not discuss this over the phone. We know that you, Grandpa, are rich. We want $2 million. We want you, Daddy, to deliver the ransom. You, Grandpa, will get the money ready. We are enclosing a cell phone. It is untraceable. But if you dial out or use it in any way, we will know. We will disappear, and you will never see the child again. Get the money ready. Give it to Daddy. Daddy, keep the money and phone near you. Go home and wait. We will call and tell you what to do. Deviate from what we ask, and you will never see your daughter again. There will be no second chance. The syntax was odd, to put it mildly. I read the note 3 times, and then I looked up at Edgar and Carson. A funny calm spread over me. Yes, this was terrifying, but receiving this note, it was also a relief. Something had finally happened. We could act now. We could get Tara back. There was hope.
Edgar stood and headed toward the corner of the room. He opened a closet door and pulled out a gym bag with a Nike logo on it. Without preamble, he said, "It's all here." He dropped the bag onto my lap. I stared down at it. $2 million? The bills are not sequential, but we have a list of all the serial numbers just in case. I looked at Carson and then back at Edgar. You don't think we should contact the FBI?
Not really, no.
Edgar perched himself on the lid of the desk, folding his arms across his chest. He smelled of barbershop bay rum, but I could sense something more primitive, more rancid that lay just beneath. Up close, his eyes had the dark rings of exhaustion.
It's your decision, Mark. You're the father. We'll respect whatever you do. But as you know, I have had some dealings with the federal authorities. Perhaps my views are colored by my own sense of their incompetence, or perhaps I am biased because I've witnessed the degree to which they are ruled by personal agendas. If it were my daughter, I'd rather trust my own judgment than theirs. I was not sure what to say or do.
Edgar took care of that. He clapped his hands once and then gestured toward the door. The note says that you should go home and wait. I think it's best if we obey. Chapter 3. The same driver was there. I slid into the back seat, the Nike bag pressed against my chest. My emotions rocketed between abject fear and the strangest tinge of elation. I could get my daughter back. I could blow it all. But first things first. Should I tell the police? I tried to calm myself, to look at it coldly, at a distance, weigh the pros and cons. That was impossible, of course. I'm a doctor. I have made life-altering decisions before. I know that the best way to do that is to remove the baggage, the ardent excess, from the equation. But my daughter's life was at stake. My own daughter. To echo what I said in the beginning, my world. The house Monica and I bought is literally around the corner from the house I grew up in and where my parents still reside. I am ambivalent about that. I really don't like living so close to my parents, but I dislike the guilt of abandoning them even more. My compromise? Live near them and then travel a lot. Lenny and Cheryl live 4 blocks away, near the Castleton Mall, in the house where Cheryl's parents had raised her. Cheryl's parents moved to Florida 6 years ago. They keep a condo up here in neighboring Roseland so they can visit their grandchildren and escape the molten lava summers of the Sunshine State. I don't particularly like living in Castleton. The town has changed very little over the past 30 years. In our youth, we scoffed at our parents, their materialism, their seemingly aimless values. Now we are our parents. We have simply replaced them, pushed Mom and Dad into whatever retirement village would have them. And our children have replaced us. But Maury's luncheonette is still on Castleton Avenue. The fire department is still mostly volunteer. The Little League still plays at Northland Field. The high-tension wires are still too close to my old elementary school. The woods behind the Brenners' house on Rockmont Terrace is still a place where kids hang out and smoke. The high school still gets between 5 and 8 national merit finalists a year, though when I was younger the list was more Jewish, while today it tilts toward the Asian community.
We turned right on Monroe Avenue and drove past the split level where I was raised. With its white paint and black shutters, with its kitchen, living room, and dining room up 3 steps on the left, and its den and garage entrance 2 steps down on the right, our house, though a bit more threadbare than most, was pretty much indistinguishable from the other cookie cutters on the block. What did make it stand out, the only thing really, was the wheelchair ramp. We put it in after my dad's 3rd stroke when I was 12 years old. My friends and I liked to skateboard down it. We built a jump out of plywood and cinder blocks and put it at the bottom. The nurse's car was in the driveway. She comes in during the days. We don't have someone full-time. My father has been confined to a wheelchair for more than 2 decades now. He cannot speak. His mouth has an ugly down-hook curve on the left side of it. Half his body is totally paralyzed, and the other half is not that much better. When the driver made the turn at Darby Terrace, I saw that my house, our house, looked the same as it had a few weeks before. I didn't know what I'd expected. Yellow crime scene tape, maybe. Or a big blood stain. But there was nothing hinting at what had occurred 2 weeks earlier. When I'd bought the house, it had been in foreclosure. For 36 years, the Levinsky family had lived there, but no one really knew them. Mrs. Levinsky had been a seemingly sweet woman with a facial tic. Mr. Levinsky was an ogre who always yelled at her out on the lawn. He scared us. One time we saw Mrs. Levinsky run out of the house in a nightgown, Mr. Levinsky chasing her with a shovel. Kids cut through every yard but theirs. When I was fresh out of college, rumors surfaced that he had abused his daughter Dina, a sad-eyed, stringy-haired waif I'd gone to school with since the 1st grade. Looking back on it, I must have been in 12 classes with Dina Levinsky, and I don't remember ever hearing her speak above a whisper, and only then, when forced to by well-meaning teachers. I never reached out to Dina. I don't know what I could have done, but I still wished that I'd tried. Sometime during that year out of college, when the rumors of Dina's abuse began to take root, the Levinskys had upped and moved away. No one knew where. The bank took over the house and began to rent it out. Monica and I made an offer a few weeks before Tara was born. When we first settled in, I'd stay awake at night and listen for, I don't know, sounds of some sort, for signs of the house's past, of the unhappiness within. I would try to figure out which bedroom had been Dina's and try to imagine what it had been like for her, what it was like now. But there were no clues here. As I said earlier, a house is mortar and brick, nothing more. 2 strange cars were parked in front of my house. My mother was standing by the front door. When I got out, she rushed me like those newscasts of returning POWs. She hugged me hard, and I got a whiff of too much perfume. I was still holding the Nike bag with the money, so it was hard for me to reciprocate. Over my mother's shoulder, Detective Bob Regan stepped out of my house. Next to him stood a large black man with a gleaming shaved head and designer sunglasses. My mother whispered, "They've been waiting for you." I nodded and moved toward them. Regan cupped a hand over his eyes, but only for effect. The sun was not that strong. The black man remained stone-like. "Where have you been?" Regan asked. When I didn't reply right away, he added, "You left the hospital more than an hour ago." I thought about the cell phone in my pocket. I thought about the bag of money in my hand. For now, I'd go for the semi-truth. "I visited my wife's grave," I said. "We need to talk, Mark." Step inside, I said. We all moved back into the house. I stopped in the foyer. Monica's body had been found less than 10 feet from where I now stood. Still in the entranceway, my eyes scanned the walls, looking for any telltale sign of violence. There was only one. I found it fairly quickly. Above the Baron's lithograph near the stairwell, a bullet hole. One created from the only bullet that had not hit either Monica or me, had been spackled over. The spackle was too white for the wall. It would need a coat of paint. I stared at it for a long moment. I heard a throat being cleared. It snapped me out of it. My mother rubbed my back and then headed to the kitchen. I showed Regan and his buddy to the living room. They took the two chairs. I took the couch. Monica and I hadn't truly decorated yet. The chairs dated back to my college dorm and looked it. The couch had come from Monica's apartment, a too formal hand-me-down that looked like something kept in storage at Versailles. It was heavy and stiff, and even in its heyday had had very little padding. "This is Special Agent Lloyd Tickner," Regan began, motioning toward the black man. "He's with the FBI." Tickner nodded. I nodded back. Regan tried to smile at me. "Good to see you feeling better," he began. "I'm not," I said. He looked puzzled. "I won't be better until I have my daughter back." "Right, of course. About that, we have a few follow-up questions, if you don't mind." I let them know I didn't. Regan coughed into his fists, buying himself time. "You have to understand something. We need to ask these questions. I don't necessarily like it. I'm sure you don't either, but these questions need to be asked. You understand?" I didn't really, but this was no time to encourage elaboration. "Go ahead," I said. "What can you tell us about your marriage?" A warning light flashed across my cortex. "What does my marriage have to do with anything?" Regan shrugged. Tickner remained still. "We're just trying to put some pieces together, that's all. My marriage has nothing to do with any of this." "I'm sure you're right, but look, Mark, the truth is, the trail is getting cold here. Every day that passes hurts us. We need to explore every avenue." "The only avenue I'm interested in is the one that leads to my daughter." "We understand that. That's the main focus of our investigation, finding out what happened to your daughter. And you, too. Let's not forget that someone tried to kill you, too, am I right?" "I guess. But see, we can't just ignore these other issues." "What other issues?" "Your marriage, for example."
"What about it?"
"When you got married, Monica was already pregnant, right?"
"What does that..."
I stopped myself. I wanted to attack with both barrels, but Lenny's words roared back at me. "Don't talk to the cops without him present." I should call him. I knew that. But something about their tone and posture. If I stopped now and said I wanted to call my lawyer, it would make me look guilty. I had nothing to hide. Why feed into their suspicions? It would only distract them. Of course, I also knew that this was how they worked, how the police played the game. But I'm a doctor. Worse, a surgeon. We often make the mistake of thinking we're smarter than everyone else. I went with honesty. "Yes, she was pregnant. So?"
"You're a plastic surgeon, correct?"
The change of subjects threw me.
"That's right."
You and your partner travel overseas and repair cleft palates, serious facial trauma, burns, that kind of thing. Something like that, yes. You travel a lot, then? A fair amount, I said. In fact, Regan said, in the 2 years before your marriage, isn't it fair to say that you were probably out of the country more than you were in it? Possibly, I said. I squirmed against the padless cushion. Could you tell me what the relevance of any of this is? Regan gave me his most disarming smile. We're just trying to get a complete picture here. Picture of what? Your work partner. He checked his notes. A Ms. Zia LaRue. Dr. LaRue, I corrected. Dr. LaRue, yes, thank you. Where is she now? Cambodia. She's performing surgery on deformed children over there? Yes. Regan tilted his head, feigning confusion. Weren't you originally scheduled to take that trip? A long time ago. How long ago? I'm not sure I follow. How long ago did you take yourself off the schedule? I don't know, I said. 8, 9 months ago, maybe. And so Dr. LaRue went instead, correct? Yes, that's correct, and the point of that is, he wouldn't bite. You like your job, don't you, Mark? Yes. You like traveling overseas, doing this commendable work? Sure. Regan scratched his head too dramatically, pretending in the most obvious way to be bewildered. So if you like the traveling, why did you cancel and let Dr. LaRue go in your place? Now I saw where he was heading. I was cutting back, I said. On travel, you mean? Yes. Why? Because I had other obligations. Those obligations being a wife and daughter, am I correct? I sat up and met his eye. Point, I said. Is there a point to all this? Regan settled back. The silent Tickner did likewise. Just trying to get a complete picture, that's all. You said that already. Yeah. Hold on. Give me a second here. Regan flipped through the pages of his notebook. Jeans and a red blouse. What? Your wife. He pointed at his notes. You said that she was wearing jeans and a red blouse that morning. More images of Monica flooded me. I tried to stem the tide. So? When we found her body, Regan said, she was naked. The tremors began in my heart. They spread down my arms, tingling my fingers. You didn't know? I swallowed. Was she? My voice died in my throat. No, Regan said. Not a mark on her other than the bullet holes. He did that help me understand head tilt again. We found her dead in this very room. Did she often parade in here with no clothes on? I told you. Overload. I tried to process this new data, keep up with him. She was wearing jeans and a red blouse. So she was dressed already. I remembered the sound of the shower. I remembered her coming out, throwing her hair back, lying on the bed, working the jeans over the hips. Yes. Definitely. Definitely. We've been through the whole house. We can't find a red blouse. Jeans, sure, she had several pairs. But no red blouse. Don't you think that's odd? Wait a second, I said. Her clothes weren't near her body?
Nope.
This made no sense. I'll look in her closet then, I said. We already did that, but sure, go ahead. Of course, I'd still like to know how clothes she was wearing ended up back in her closet. Wouldn't you? I had no answer. Do you own a gun, Dr. Seidman? Another subject shift. I tried to keep up, but my head was spinning. Yes? What kind? A Smith & Wesson 38. It belonged to my father. Where do you keep it? There's a compartment in the bedroom closet. It's on the top shelf in a lockbox. Regan reached behind him and pulled out the metal lockbox. This it? Yes. Open it. He tossed it to me. I caught it. The gray-blue metal was cold. But more than that, it felt shockingly light. I moved the wheels to the right combination and flipped it open. I poked through the legal documents. The car title, the deed on the house, the property survey. But that was just to get my bearings. I knew right away. The gun was gone. You and your wife were both shot with a 38, Regan said. And yours seems to be missing. I kept my eyes on the box as if I expected the weapon to suddenly materialize in it. I tried to put it together, but nothing was coming to me. Any idea where the gun is? I shook my head. And something else strange, Regan said. I looked up at him. You and Monica were shot with different 38s. Excuse me? He nodded. Yeah, I found it hard to believe, too. I made ballistics check it twice. You and your wife were shot with two different guns, both 38s. And yours seems to be missing. Regan shrugged theatrically. Help me understand, Mark. I looked at their faces. I didn't like what I saw. Lenny's warning came back to me again, firmer this time. I want to call my lawyer, I said. You sure? Yes. Go ahead. My mother had been standing by the kitchen door, wringing her hands. How much had she heard? Judging by her face, too much. Mom looked at me expectantly. I nodded, and she went to call Lenny. I folded my arms, but that didn't feel right. I tapped my foot. Tickner took off the sunglasses. He met my eye and spoke for the first time. What's in the bag? He asked me. I just looked at him. That gym bag you've been groping. Tickner's voice, belying his tough looks, had a nerdy cadence to it, a quasi-whine quality. What's in it? This had all been a mistake. I should have listened to Lenny. I should have called him right away. Now I was not sure how to reply. In the background, I heard my mother urging Lenny to hurry. I was sifting through a response that might work as a semi-truthful stall. None were convincing when a sound ripped my attention away. The cell phone. The one the kidnappers had sent to my father-in-law began to ring.
Chapter 4 Tickner and Regan waited for me to answer. I excused myself, rising before they had a chance to react. My hand fumbled with the phone as I hurried outside. The sun hit me full in the face. I blinked and looked down at the keypad. The phone's answer button was located in a different spot from mine. Across the street, two girls donning brightly hued helmets were riding neon bikes. Ribbon strips of pink cascaded out of the handlebars of one. When I was little, this neighborhood sheltered more than a dozen kids my age. We used to meet up after school. I don't remember what games we played. We were never organized enough for, say, a real game of baseball or anything like that. But they all involved hiding and chasing and some form of feigned or borderline real violence. Childhood in suburbia is purportedly a time of innocence, but how many of those days ended in tears for at least one kid? We would argue, shift alliances, make declarations of friendship and war, and like some short-term memory case, it was all forgotten the next day. A clean slate every afternoon. New coalitions forged. A new kid running home in tears. My thumb finally touched down on the right button. I pressed it and brought the phone to my ear, all in one move. My heart thumped against my ribcage. I cleared my throat, and feeling like a total idiot, I simply said, "Hello?" Answer yes or no. The voice had the robotic hum of one of those customer care phone systems, the ones that tell you to press 1 for service, press 2 to check the status of an order. Do you have the money? Yes. Do you know the Garden State Plaza? In Paramus, I said. In exactly 2 hours from now, I want you parked at the north lot. That's near Nordstrom's, Section 9. Someone will approach your car. But if you're not alone, we disappear. If you're being followed, we disappear. If I smell a cop, we disappear. There will be no second chances. Do you understand? Yes, but when... Click. I let my hand drop to my side. Numbness seeped in. I did not fight it. The little girls across the street were quarreling now. I couldn't hear the specifics, but the word "my" popped up a lot. That simple syllable accentuated and drawn out. An SUV sped around the corner. I watched it as though from above. The brakes shrieked. The driver's side door was open before the car had come to a complete stop. It was Lenny. He took one look at me and picked up his pace. "Mark?" "You were right." I nodded toward the house. Regan was standing by the door now. "They think I'm involved." Lenny's face darkened. His eyes narrowed, his pupils shrinking to pinpoints. In sports, you call it putting on your game face. Lenny was becoming Cujo. He stared at Regan as if deciding which limb to chew off. "You talk to them?" "A little." Lenny jerked his gaze toward me. "Didn't you tell them you wanted counsel?" "Not at first." "Damn it, Mark, I told you. I got a ransom demand." That made Lenny pull up. I checked my watch. Paramus was a 40-minute ride. With traffic, it could take as much as an hour. I had time, but not much. I started filling him in. Lenny gave Regan another glare and led me farther away from the house. We stopped at the curb, those familiar cloud-gray stones that lie on property lines like sets of teeth, and then, like two children, we squatted deep and sat on them. Our knees were at our chins. I could see Lenny's skin between the argyle sock and tapered cuff. Squatting like this was uncomfortable as hell. The sun was in our eyes. We both looked off rather than at each other. Again, just like in our youths. It made it easier to spill it all out. I spoke quickly. Midway through my recap, Regan began to move toward us. Lenny turned to him and shouted, "Your balls!" Regan stopped. "What? Are you arresting my client?" "No." Lenny pointed toward Regan's crotch. "Then I'm going to have them bronzed and hanging from my rearview mirror if you take another step." Regan straightened his spine. We have some questions for your client. Tough. Go abuse the rights of someone with a lesser lawyer. Lenny made a dismissive gesture and nodded at me to continue. Regan did not look happy, but he took two steps back. I glanced at my watch again. Only 5 minutes had passed since the ransom call. I finished up while Lenny kept the laser glare aimed at Regan. "You want my opinion?" he said. "Yes." Still glaring. "I think you should tell them."
"You sure?"
"Hell no." "Would you?" I said. "I mean, if it was one of your kids." Lenny gave it a few seconds. "I can't put myself in your place, if that's what you mean. But yeah, I think I would. I play the odds. The odds are better when you tell the cops. Doesn't mean it works out every time, but they're experts at this. We're not." Lenny put his elbows on his knees and rested his chin in his hands. A pose from his youth. "That's the opinion of Lenny the friend," he went on. "Lenny the friend would encourage you to tell them."
"And Lenny the lawyer?" I asked.
"He would be more insistent. He would strongly urge you to come forward."
"Why?"
"If you go off with $2 million and it vanishes, even if you get Tara back, their suspicions will be, to put it mildly, aroused."
"I don't care about that. I just want Tara back."
"Understood." "Or should I say, Lenny the friend understands." Now it was Lenny's turn to check his watch. My insides felt hollow, scooped out canoe style. I could almost hear the tick, tick. It was maddening. I tried again to do the rational thing, to list the pros on the right, the cons on the left, and then add them up. But the tick, tick would not stop. Lenny had talked about playing the odds. "I don't gamble. I'm not a risk taker." Across the street, one of the little girls shouted, "I'm telling!" She stormed down the street. The other girl laughed at her and got back on her bike. I felt my eyes well up. I wished like hell Monica were here. I shouldn't be making this decision alone. She should be in on this too. I looked back at the front door. Regan and Tickner were both outside now. Regan had his arms folded across his chest, bouncing on the balls of his feet. Tickner did not move, his face the same placid pool. Were these men I could trust with my daughter's life? Would they put Tara first, or as Edgar had suggested, would they follow some unseen agenda? The tick, tick grew louder, more insistent. Someone had murdered my wife. Someone had taken my child. For the past few days, I had asked myself, why? Why us? Trying again to stay rational and not allowing myself extended forays in the deep end of the pity pool. But no answer came. I could see no motive, and maybe that was most frightening of all. Maybe there was no reason. Maybe it was just pure bad luck. Lenny stared straight ahead and waited. Tick, tick, tick. "Let's tell them," I said. Their reaction surprised me. They panicked. Regan and Tickner tried to hide it, of course, but their body language was suddenly all wrong. The flutter in the eyes, the tightness at the corner of their mouths, the unduly modulated FM soft rock timbre in their tones. The time frame was simply too close for them. Tickner quickly dialed up the FBI specialist on kidnapping negotiations to enlist his help. He cupped his hand around the mouthpiece while he spoke into it. Regan got hold of his police colleagues in Paramus. When Tickner hung up, he said to me,
we'll get people to cover the mall. Discreetly, of course. We're going to try to get men in cars near every exit and on Route 17 in both directions. We'll have people inside the mall by all the entrances. But I want you to listen to me closely, Dr. Seidman. Our expert tells us that we should try to stall him. Maybe we can get the kidnapper to postpone. No, I said. They won't just run away, Tickner said. They want the money. My daughter has been with them for almost 3 weeks, I said. I'm not putting this off. He nodded, not liking it, trying to keep up with the placid. Then I want to put a man in the car with you. No. He can duck down in the back. No, I said again. Tickner tried another avenue. Or, better yet, we've done this before. We tell the kidnapper that you can't drive. Hell, you're just out of the hospital. We have one of our men drive instead. We say it's your cousin. I frowned and looked at Regan. Didn't you say you thought my sister might be involved? It's possible, yes. Don't you think she'd know if this guy was a cousin or not? Tickner and Regan both hesitated and then nodded in unison. Good point, Regan said. Lenny and I exchanged a glance. These were the professionals I was trusting with Tara's life. The thought was not comforting. I started for the door. Tickner put a hand on my shoulder. Where are you going? Where the hell do you think? Sit down, Dr. Seidman. No time, I countered. I have to start heading up there. There could be traffic. We can clear the traffic. Oh, and that won't look suspicious, I said. I highly doubt he's going to follow you from here. I spun on him. And you'd be willing to risk your child's life on that? He paused just long enough. You don't get it, I went on, in his face now. I don't care about the money or if they get away. I just want my daughter back. We understand that, Tickner said, but there is something you're forgetting. What? Please, he said, sit down. Look, do me a favor, okay? Just let me stand. I'm a doctor. I know the delivering bad news drill as well as anyone. Don't try to play me. Tickner held his palms up and said, fair enough. He proceeded to take a long, lingering breath. Stall tactic. I was not in the mood. So what is it? I said. Whoever did this, he began. They shot you. They killed your wife. I understand that. No, I don't think you do. Think about it a second. We can't just let you go in on your own. Whoever did this tried to end your life. They shot you twice and left you for dead. Mark, Regan said, moving closer, we threw some wild theories at you before. The problem is that's all they are. Theories. We don't know what these guys are really after. Maybe this is just a simple kidnapping, but if it is, it's not like any we've seen before. His interrogation face was gone now, replaced with an aw shucks, eyebrow-raised attempt at openness. What we do know with certainty is that they tried to kill you. You don't try to kill the parents if you're just after ransom. Maybe they planned on getting the money from my father-in-law, I said. Then why did they wait so long? I had no answer. Maybe, Tickner went on, this isn't about kidnapping at all. At least not at first. Maybe that's become a sideline. Maybe you and your wife were the targets all along. And maybe they want to finish the job. You think this is a setup? It's a strong possibility, yes. So what are you advising? Tickner took that one. Don't go alone.
buy us some time so we can prepare properly. Let them call you back. I looked at Lenny. He saw it and nodded. That's not possible, Lenny said. Tickner turned at him hard. With all due respect, your client is in grave danger here. So is my daughter, I said. Simple words. This decision was a no-brainer when you kept it simple. I pulled away and started toward my car. Keep your people at a distance. Chapter 5. There was no traffic, so I made it to the mall with plenty of time to spare. I turned the engine off and sat back. I glanced around. I figured that the feds and cops were probably still on me, but I couldn't see them. That was a good thing, I guess. Now what? No idea. I waited some more. I fiddled with the radio, but nothing caught my attention. It turned on the CD player tape deck. When Donald Fagen and Steely Dan began singing Black Cow, I felt a slight jerk. I had not listened to this particular tape since, what, my college days. Why did Monica have it? And then with a renewed pang, I realized that Monica had been the last to use this car, that this may have been the last song she ever heard. I watched the shoppers prepare for mall entry. I concentrated on the young mothers, the way they flipped open the back door of the minivan, the way they unfolded the baby strollers midair with a magician's flourish, the way they struggled to release their offspring from safety seats that reminded me of Buzz Aldrin's on Apollo 11, the way the mothers skirted forward, heads high, smartly pressing the remote control that slid the minivan door to a close. The mothers, all of them, looked so blasé. Their children were with them. Their safety, what with the 5-star side collision rating and NASA sleek car seats, was a given. And here I sat with a bag of ransom money, hoping to get my daughter back. The thin line. I wanted to roll down the window and shout out a warning. We were getting close to drop time. The sun beat down on my windshield. I reached for my sunglasses, but then thought better of it. I don't know why. Would putting on my sunglasses somehow make the kidnapper uneasy? No, I don't think so. Or maybe it would. Better to just leave them off. Take no chances. My shoulders bunched up. I kept trying to look around without, for some odd reason, looking conspicuous about it. Whenever someone parked near me or walked anywhere in the vicinity of my car, my stomach tightened, and I wondered, was Tara nearby? We were at the 2-hour mark now. I wanted this over. The next few minutes would decide everything. I knew that. Calm. I needed to stay calm. Tickner's warning reverberated in my head. Would someone simply walk up to my car and blow my brains out? It was, I realized, a very real possibility. When the cell phone rang, I startled forward. I brought it to my ear and barked a too quick hello. The robotic voice said, "Pull out by the west exit." I was confused. Which way is west? Follow the signs for Route 4. Take the overpass. We're watching. If someone follows, we disappear. Keep the phone near your ear. I obeyed with gusto. My right hand pressed the phone against my ear to the point where I started losing circulation. My left hand gripped the wheel as if preparing to tear it off. Get on Route 4 heading west. I took the right turn and jug-handled onto the highway. I looked in my rearview mirror to see if anyone was following me. Hard to tell. The robotic voice said, "You'll see a strip mall." "There's a million strip malls," I said. "It's on the right, next to a store selling baby cribs in front of the Paramus Road exit. I saw it.
Okay.
Pull in there.